excited this morning to talk to Bill Lucy, who apparently is a Long Island Sound keeper. The Long Island Sound keeper. Bill, I got to be honest, I don't know what that means. That sounds like a very amazing title, though. Like, I'm jealous. I want to know what a sound keeper is. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Now, are you the sound keeper? Like, are there multiple sound keepers, or is there just one? Because if so, that's really, wow.
So, that's a good question. Well, there are well over 300 keeper organizations worldwide. The Long Island Sound Keeper, right now, there's only one of us. That's me. The person who had that job before me, some of the folks in Stratford and Bridgeport may remember Terry Backer.
Yes.
He was one of the... Yes, remember Terry? Yeah, so he's one of the eight founding members of what's called the Waterkeeper Alliance. And so first they expanded to having individual organizations that are dedicated to defending their own local water. So the idea is a grassroots movement. If you fish and swim or boat on a body of water, you're going to have passion and more interest in defending it.
Cool.
So then it went from there to, I think we're in over 40 countries now.
Wow.
So it's quite a movement that's been spreading, and one of the founders started right here at Long Island Sound.
That's very neat. And, you know, and it's so important that we protect our waters. It's one of the natural things that we were given as humans, and not all of us take care of it. So I love that we have people like Soundkeeper. So what does, like, a day-to-day work day look like for you, Bill? I'm sure it changes week to week, but, like, what does a Soundkeeper do?
Yeah, it changes hourly, it seems like. So, for example, the Connecticut legislative session is about to start. In the new year. So I spend a lot of time at the Connecticut Capitol lobbying for healthy fisheries and clean water policy. I'll also do that in the federal level. For example, this fall, we went up and testified at the New England Fisheries Management Council to try and protect our river herring coming back to Long Island Sound.
Mm.
We do a lot of dam removals to let the fish get back to spawning. I'll be out of the boat patrolling. We'll map out culverts. And if we get watchdog reports, we call them, if someone smells sewage, we'll head over there in the boat. We'll sample that outfall, and then we'll process it in our lab. We have a new lab down in Larchmont, New York. And we... find out if there's a problem, and then we contact the people in charge and try and solve that problem. So a lot of water quality, pollution, patrolling, a lot of policy work, law work, and of course we get muddy and dirty out there also.
Oh, I would imagine. But, you know, I have a 4-year-old son, so I've become very acclimated to how fun it is to get dirty and, you know, get muddy and all those good things. He would love that. So that portion sounds great, but that's a lot of pressure. Bill, that's a lot of pressure that you have to face lawmakers, and you've got to, you know, you've got to state your case, and you've got to hope for, you know, I would think funding and support and initiatives to be put into place. That's, I think that's a very intense, I think, role that you're in. I mean, did you have to go through, like, I know in high school we had what was called youth in government, where you learned how to, like, lobby, or you learned how to, you know, push your... you know, your initiative or whatever your goal was in front of an entire room of lawmakers. You know, like, what kind of training or background did you have to be in to do the role that you're doing? It's one thing to do water conservation, right, and to do, studies and data and all that. But to be able to present it, that's a big job.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. It brings me back to eighth grade. I went to public school in Wilton, Connecticut back in the 70s and early 80s, and we formed the independent Fairfield County, where the Fairfield County seceded. We had to create transportation committees and create a budget. We all sat in a semicircle and played the role of legislators. So that may have been the first part of it. And then I went to school for fisheries biology up in the University of Vermont. And in order to get a biology degree from that institution, you had to have 4 communications degrees. So not only did you have to be able to do the science, you also had to be able to communicate it out to the public. which is a key issue, right? There's a lot going on. There's more data discovered every day, and it can become overwhelming for the general public and policymakers. And then I also did a lot of development work down in Central America. I was down in Guatemala for a couple of years doing fish pond extension work. And that was a lot of interaction with the government agencies and communicating with people in a second language for me. And then I went up to Alaska, where I worked for the federal government for a while, and then got into commercial fishing and ended up working for what's called a home rule bureau. In Alaska, the home rule bureau actually has the ability to tax, much different than the system in Connecticut. So we were constantly going to the governor's office and, you know, trying to get capital projects approved and trying to get laws passed that were beneficial to our borough and our constituents. So I think going to Alaska, where it's a small state, so you know everybody, and there's instant feedback loop, I think that trained me fairly well for the fast pace of the Connecticut legislature.
That's amazing. And we're talking this morning to Bill Lucy, who is the Long Island Soundkeeper. And Bill, I knew I liked you, but it sounds like for a stint there, you were a Burlington boy. So was I. I went to Champlain. So you were at UVM. Did you like it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, there was quite a few colleges in Burlington. It was a very fun town back in the 80s and early 90s when I was there. Yeah, I love Vermont. I still have a lot of friends up there that you know, raise beef cows and maple sugar for a living. Yeah. It's a nice pace up there.
It is. Yeah, my husband. That's where I met my husband in college, and we lived up there on and off for several years. After we were up there for about 10 years before I came back down to be with family in Connecticut. But yeah, it's a great place, and it's I always get very tickled with excitement whenever I hear about St. Mike's kids or UVM kids or other Champlainers. So I love that. I love that you went to UVM. It's a great school. Great school. So. I love that. Very, very cool. Good morning. We have the distinct pleasure this morning of speaking with the Long Island Soundkeeper, and his name is Bill Lucy. And recently I saw an article in Hearst Media talking about lobster traps being pulled from Long Island Sound, and I did a little research during that quick commercial break. It says 2 decades after Connecticut's lobster industry collapsed, federal funding was approved to begin removing some of the hundreds of thousands of lobster traps left on the floor of Long Island Sound, and that was in March of this year. So, Bill, could you tell us the latest on this? What has been pulled? What are you guys finding? Why does it matter that these are being taken up? Talk to us a little bit about this.
Sure. It's pretty amazing what's out there. Just to back up a little bit, Cornell Cooperative Community Extension over in Suffolk County has been retrieving pots off the bottom of Long Island Sound for over a dozen years now. They're in the 20,000 something range of removing pots. And so that's where we got the idea, and as well as some information from Chesapeake Bay, where they've removed thousands of pots. So many, in fact, that they estimate they've returned $5 million worth of blue crab back to the commercial fishery. Those crabs are being lost in the pots and not available for harvest. So that was the impetus for this whole program that was started essentially by a law that had to be changed at the Connecticut State Legislature back in 2018. So I worked closely with Senator Craig Miner and Joe Gresko, Representative Joe Gresko as well, to be able for people who were not licensed commercial fishermen, such as myself, to be designated by the commissioner to go out and pull up old pots. In the old days, there was a lot of pirating going on and people stealing other people's pots. And so the laws were very strict that only the owner of the pot and law enforcement could touch those pots. And I grew up with friends who were lobster fishermen out of Norwalk, and I did some lobster fishing out of Long Island as well in the mid-90s. So I understand why those laws needed to be that way. But once we got that law changed, we started down a road of putting together a program to expand the work from Long Island to Connecticut. And so that's where we are now. There's an existing grant that was put in by Cornell, and then the funding that you're discussing from this spring that was led by the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. And that was an earmark, essentially. Earmarks came back, and it was seed money to get the program really rolling on the Connecticut side. And so how it breaks down is the Eastern Sound is covered by Project Oceanography. They're out of Avery Point at the Yukon campus. So they're contracting with lobster fishermen up that part of the sound. Save the Sound and the Soundkeeper program were basically from the Connecticut River down to Bridgeport. And then the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk takes it from there all the way down to the Connecticut border and in the Sound. So we have three distinct groups in Connecticut. We have Cornell over in the New York waters, and it's been fairly productive. I've been working out of the Bridgeport area, and back in the day, that was an incredible fishery for lobster. And there are lines of traps that go from the coastline out to the border. And so we're contracted with local fishermen because they have by far the best knowledge of how everything works. And in our particular section, we hook up with a line of traps usually within 5 minutes. And then we just start pulling. And we've got strings of 15 traps in one string to some that we don't know because we fill the boat up and cut the line and buoy it off and then go deliver them. So there's a lot of pots out there. And what we're finding is a lot of black sea bass, more tautog or blackfish. Those love to get in the pots, and then a handful of lobsters as well as whelk or conch.
Wow, that's amazing. And so, I mean, it's how long do you think, Bill Lucy, it's going to take to remove all of them? We understand, obviously, the environmental impact of leaving them down there and just kind of rotting away. But how long do you think it's going to take us, you know, ballpark, to really clean just that up in Long Island Sound?
That's a good question. So Cornell has been doing this for a long time, and they're the ones that came up with an estimate of how many pots are down there. I believe it's 800,000 to 1.2 million. I've talked with a lot of the commercial fishermen on the Connecticut side that don't believe there's that many left. But from where we look, there's still a lot. And 20 years, 30 years, I mean, eventually, geologically, the sound is going to fill in from all the sediment from the rivers. And so we notice when we pull these pots up, some of them are buried 2, 3, 4 inches in the muck. So the problem with that is the escape vents don't work because they're blocked by the mud, but the entry vents are still available. So the creatures can go in, and while some of them may find their way out, unless the top rots off, that's when they get stuck. So we're going to be looking at least another 10, 20 years of pecking away at this. And what we're doing is we're using GPS technology to see where we've been and what places we may have missed. So we don't really know the full scope of the problem besides the Cornell estimate. But one project we've put in for as well is a sonar sweep. So a lot of different organizations, U.S. Geological Survey, the Army Corps of Engineers, different entities have done bottom mapping using sound. And we're going to gather all that information if we're awarded the next grant and see where all the potential pot locations are. And so once we run out of big concentrations that the fishermen know about, we're going to have to hunt a little bit more.
Well, Bill Lucy, first of all, I would love for you to come back on the show. I think you're an incredible resource, not just for WICC, but for Long Island Sound. So I would love to have you back on. And in 2023, if you're open to it, if you and your team are open to it, I'd love to go out on the water with you and see just what the process is like finding a lobster trap, pulling it in, and looking at it after it's sat underneath the water for so long. Do you think it's something we could talk about arranging? I'd be very fascinated to watch this process in real time and report back to my listeners.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the only way to understand it really is to see it. And the pots come up with coral on them and all kinds of life. And you know, really, if the top has got is removed, sometimes the wildlife can use it as habitat. And it's really, I guess, the most fulfilling part of it is being able to talk with the fishermen, because they're out there so frequently that their observations of what's going on with climate change and fish populations, it's really, I commercial fish for many years in Alaska, and it kind of brings back that common sense knowledge that you can get from people who really work in the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you're welcome any time. We're going to be back on the water in January, and it could be chilly.
Well, you know what, Bill, you and I, we share that cold weather tolerance. You know, Burlington really got me ready for it. You know, being a reporter in the middle of January, a one-man band trying to film without gloves on, I think I'm going to go for it. I think it would be really eye-opening, and I would really love to see the work that you guys do and talk to fishermen and be able to report that back to people here. So I appreciate that opportunity, and we will connect after the holidays. That would be really great. And thank you for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime, Melissa. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, Bill Lucy is the Long Island Sound Keeper. And I'm so glad we got to connect, Bill. I hope you have a wonderful holiday. And I look forward to having you back on the air really soon. Pretty incredible story that I learned about and wanted to share ahead of Christmas. A woman named Katie Stewart, who's from Fairfield, was playing with her 4-year-old son when she reportedly passed out at home. At the time, she was 20 weeks pregnant. She arrived at the emergency department at St. Vincent's Medical Center, where she was diagnosed with a type of aneurysm, and it could be presented during pregnancy and is a life-threatening condition to both the mom and the baby. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this diagnosis and later, we will talk to Katie as well about her story. This morning, back on the show is Dr. Daniel Gottschall. Twice in 1 week, I am very lucky to be able to chat with you. He's an OBGYN as well as Vice President of Medical Affairs over at Hartford Healthcare's Fairfield region for St. V's. And I know Katie is not your patient, Dr. Gottschall, but this morning you can kind of talk about what she was going through. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Pleasure to be back with you. Yeah, Katie was having a normal pregnancy. Like you mentioned, she was 20 weeks pregnant with her second child. She had no really underlying medical issues, although she did in the past suffer from something that was somewhat significant in that she had inflammation of her pancreas, which some people can get, and she had her gallbladder removed, you know, prior to her pregnancy. But ultimately, she describes that she was awakened by discomfort kind of in her left upper quadrant, right, kind of underneath her heart, but not in her chest cavity, kind of upper part of her stomach. And then the next thing she knows, she had passed out. Her husband luckily called emergency medical services that responded incredibly quickly and brought her to St. Vincent's, where it was noted that she had internal bleeding. And originally, the source wasn't recognized, although the only organ in that area is the spleen. And the spleen is a solid organ that probably many people know about that helps fight infections. And she was bleeding from that area. And the reality is splenic artery aneurysms, which is a balloon that develops in a weakness in the blood vessel that feeds the spleen. And during pregnancy, there's a great deal of extra blood that your body creates in order to support, obviously, the baby, both the nutrition of the baby as well as, you know, taking care of the oxygenation, et cetera. And that actually ruptured. And if that ruptured, you can imagine all that blood that was running through that artery and feeding this important organ now was, you know, silently spilling into her abdomen. So coming to the emergency room, the team very quickly recognized her blood pressure was low, her heart rate was high, signs and symptoms of bleeding internally. They gave her massive transfusion protocols, and really it took the emergency room team, what's called an interventional radiologist, actually was able to identify the vessel and stop the bleeding for a short term. One of the general surgeons Dr. Siddiqui, as well as one of our upper GI experts, hepatobiliary surgeons, Dr. Chuck Cha. After she is stabilized, we're able to take her to the operating room along with the obstetrician to make sure that the baby did well during surgery and actually remove her spleen and remove that area of concern in that blood vessel. This is a very uncommon issue, but the reality is, Melissa, that probably 95% of people don't know they have this. Mm. And when they present this way, they tend to die from this absolutely very frightening issue. And this is just, like you said, a miracle that she recognized it and that the team was able to act incredibly quickly and save her life.
So a few things, Dr. Gottschall, because I think you've painted this picture where we can now ask educated questions following up. First of all, it sounds like you were saying time was of the essence. She recognized something was weird. She passed out. Actions were made very quickly. An amazing doctor work to be able to recognize this and remove the spleen and handle it. First of all, she kept her baby. She's okay?
Yeah. No, my understanding is she's still pregnant.
Wow. I mean, how, and of course, every case I'm sure fluctuates a little bit. But when you have a rupture like that happen, like, for example, when you are delivering, you only have so much time if your water breaks, if your child has not been delivered yet, if your baby hasn't been delivered, they run out of oxygen. So, like, you know, my water broke with my son. I was in labor for 23 and a half hours and he never came out. That's why we had to do an emergency C-section, because he ran out of oxygen. So when you have something like this happen, how much time do you, like, on average have before it's just too late?
Well, that's a good question. So remember that the baby is solely dependent on the mom.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, you know, pregnancy complicated this, and this is more common that it presents in pregnancy. But the only way to save the baby, obviously, was to save the mom. And really, every second mattered. Luckily, you know, her bleeding kind of clotted off on her own a little bit, but it required the team very urgently replacing the blood products that she had lost. And that was done in the emergency department, and then gathering the emergency team, which, like I said, was the emergency physicians, the interventional radiology doctors that actually did the initial procedure that stabilized her in order to be able to wait to be able to take her with the two surgeons to the operating room. So some of this was just, like you said, a miracle and luck. But a lot of this was, you know, the team recognizing what the issue was and moving very, very rapidly in order to make life-saving decisions.
And really quick, before we take a break, Dr. Gottschall, you said it's a very rare condition to get during pregnancy, but that's mostly when you see people get it as well, they're pregnant. Do you have any stats? Like, how many women go through this?
Yeah, I mean, it's well less than 1 in 1,000, probably closer to 1 in 5,000.
Wow.
However, you know, what we're taught is when a pregnant woman presents with this pain, you know, on the left upper side, and for your listeners, most of the time, it's very, you know, pregnant women can have all kinds of muscular skeletal complaints, certainly. They can become a little bit more gassier in pregnancy because the gastrointestinal system slows down in order to extract every last bit of nutrition that mom takes in to be able to give it to that growing fetus inside. But, you know, if they have persistent pain on the left upper quadrant, that's, you know, a red flag for obstetricians and should be for patients to call their doctors and let the appropriate tests be done in order to rule this out.
This morning, we're chatting with Dr. Daniel Gottschall, and he's an OBGYN, excuse me, and the VP of Medical Affairs for Hartford Healthcare Fairfield Region. And we were just telling you a synopsis of the story of Katie Stewart, a Fairfield resident who found out while she was pregnant that she was diagnosed with, how do you pronounce it? Is it splenic?
Yeah, splenic. Potato, potato.
Okay, I was gonna say splenic, but then I'm like, I'm no doctor. So an artery aneurysm, which is it's very rare to get, but if you are to get it, most times it would be while you are pregnant. And you know, and Dr. Gottschall just said one in about 5,000 women, give or take, would go through something like this. And I apologize for having you repeat this, but the survival rate of getting this seemed pretty slim.
Yeah, it's probably less than 5%.
Wow. That's amazing. Was there anything Katie could have done? Like, how does this even happen? What causes this?
You know, I mean, sometimes it's just what we say congenital, that the people are born with it. I think in Katie's piece, probably the complicating factor is she did have pancreatitis and had, you know, she would probably explain to you she had had, pancreatic cyst that needed to be drained at some point in her life, and that inflammation probably helped weaken the blood vessel. And now with that extra blood flow going through it, like I mentioned, during a pregnant state, it probably accentuated the weakness in that blood vessel. And then for whatever reason, sometimes a weakness in a blood vessel can just rupture, almost like if you had a people think of an aneurysm, you look at like one of those old inner tubes and you could see like a little bubble or weakness in the inner tube. And that weakness in the arterial wall is susceptible to rupturing and breaking open. And therefore, instead of the blood running through it, now the blood is leaking out of it.
But it sounds like essentially there was nothing she could have done to prevent this. So what can people be aware of, you know, especially if they're pregnant? Are there things that they should be, you know, keeping note of? Like you said, she had gotten her gallbladder removed. She had pancreatitis. Like, so is this something that, you know, doctors should be like, hey, this is a possibility. It's very rare, but it's something you should keep an eye out for. And if so, what symptoms should you be looking for?
Yeah, really, there is no screening exam for this, even for people with that history. The only thing is if, unfortunately, people have discomfort in that area, even discomfort that comes and goes, they shouldn't be shy about bringing that to their doctor's attention. But like I said, it's very uncommon, and I've been practicing obstetrics for 30 years, and this is the first time, despite reading it in textbooks and journal articles, et cetera, that we've actually seen one in the facilities that I've been working at.
Wow. So. That's unbelievable. And coming up on the show later this morning, we are going to be hearing from Katie. She will tell us, you know, those moments leading up to what happened, her experience, and hear it firsthand from her, the miracle that they are celebrating this holiday season. And Dr. Gottschall, while I know Katie was not your patient, I do appreciate the work that you do as an OBGYN. And I thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining what medical issues she had gone through and just sharing the stats with us. I really appreciate you educating us this morning.
Sure. My pleasure.
I hope you have a Merry Christmas, Dr. Gottschall, and I'll talk to you soon.
Same to you. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much. Dr. Daniel Gottschall, again, VP of Medical Affairs for Hartford Healthcare Fairfield Region here on WICC. I feel incredibly honored to be speaking with this woman this morning, Katie Stewart, who's from Fairfield. And good morning to you, Katie. Thank you so much for coming on the show and for being willing to talk to me and my audience and sharing your story. How are you?
I'm good. Much, much better than I was about a month ago, that's for sure.
Yeah. So first of all, Katie, before we even get into your story, how are you feeling and how are you still pregnant?
I am. Yeah, I'm still pregnant. My son is he's healthy. He's strong. So it truly is a miracle that both of us survived when it happened.
How far along are you?
I am 25 weeks now.
Congratulations. That's so beautiful.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
And you have another child, right?
I do. I have another son, a 4-year-old boy, RJ.
That's beautiful. Well, I'm so happy for you and your family. So let's talk about what happened a month ago. You were apparently at home with your other son, and you passed out. What happened?
Yeah. So it was very strange. I mean, you know, it was a typical morning. About 6:30 in the morning, I gotten up with RJ. There's really nothing out of the norm, except that I was having some abdominal pain. It was in my left side, so it was like near my rib cage. I quite honestly, in the moment, didn't think much of it because, you know, like any pregnant person knows, you get a lot of different pains just from muscle stretching or digestion. But what was different about this was that I suddenly started having trouble with vision in one of my eyes. I felt really weak, and I just happened to pass out. And my husband, Ross, he actually came down. He heard me making very strange, like, snoring sounds. And luckily, he called the ambulance right away. He was able to wake me up at that point, but I was completely blind. I was in a cold sweat. Half my body was numb. I wasn't really able to speak very well. But what was, you know, particularly strange was I was cognizant most of the time, so I could understand everything that was really going on around me. But, you know, I'm just so grateful, you know, Ross, you know, just to have me go to St. Vincent's Hospital, which is, you know, really what saved my life in the end, because every minute truly counted with what had happened. And, you know, in the ambulance, I could hear them, you know, reading off my blood pressure, which was remarkably low. And at the time, I was thinking, you know, am I having a stroke? Is something going on with my unborn son? But, you know, the most prevalent thoughts in my head were, you know, number one, is my unborn son okay? And, you know, my other son, RJ, he just hasn't had enough time with me. You know, he's only 4 years old. I just didn't believe that how can my time be up so quickly? You know, I had so much to live for. So I'm just so grateful, you know, Ross is there and he acted quickly. You know, the team, the ED team and the team at St. Vincent's, they were just so diligent because this whole thing could have really ended completely differently. So it's truly a miracle that me and my son, you know, were both healthy and alive and growing strong.
So we had Dr. Gotchel on earlier this morning, OBGYN and VP of Medical Affairs for Hartford Healthcare's Fairfield region. And while I know he's not your doctor, Katie, he told us that about 1 in 5,000 women will go through what you did and less than 5% will survive it. What was that like the process? You said you were cognizant of what was going on around you. I mean, take us to those moments in learning that you have this pretty rare thing that you couldn't really prevent. It's not like you caused it. Dr. Gotchel had said that I guess you got your gallbladder removed. You did have pancreatitis at one time, but other than that, there's no screening process. There's nothing it's not like you could have exercised more or eaten certain things. Like it's sort of unfortunately a luck of the draw, if you want to even call it that. What was sort of going through your mind when this was all sort of happening in front of you?
You know, the hardest part, I think, was, you know, being pregnant through the whole thing. And just, it's so hard, you know, as a mother to worry about everybody else. You know, it's sort of like the last thought in your mind is, well, am I going to be okay through this? Because I was just more concerned, you know, about my son and my husband and my unborn son. And, you know, now being able to kind of like look back at everything that happened, it's like, holy smokes, you know, if I hadn't survived, you know, my son, my unborn son wouldn't have survived either. So it was a really, really serious situation. And, in the moment, you know, they had done a blood transfusion and then we had talked about the MRI because, as many people know, MRIs can be, you know, very dangerous to unborn children, but you have to weigh, you know, the pros and cons. And obviously in this situation, that MRI was really what was the telling point to figure out exactly where the aneurysm was and to quickly kind of get to a solution for it.
Have you come up, just out of curiosity, have you come up with a name for your unborn son yet?
We do, yes. We do have a name for him, so... He's all ready, and you know, he comes on April 8th, and we're just really excited for him to be on the other side.
Yeah, it's I mean, the reason I ask is I thought if you don't have any ideas, it's got to be something like that in Roman terms means miracle or gift or holy moly, something like that. I mean, his name has to be something along the lines of, like, you know, John, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're here, Stuart. I mean, it's got to be something like that, right? I mean, his middle name has to be, I can't believe you're here, you know, something like that. Yeah. But what an incredible journey. And you're so right. I know I have a 4-year-old as well. And you just, all you think about is, are the people around you? And then you realize, like, whoa, I'm this unit. And if I go down, then, like, everyone's coming down with me, kind of a thing. So I totally can understand what you're saying. And we're talking this morning to Katie Stewart. She's from Fairfield, and she got what is called a splenic artery aneurysm. And it's pretty rare. It's really rare. We had talked to Dr. Gottschall this morning about it. He said it's like 1 in 5,000 women, give or take, who get this. And there's less than a 5% survival rate. How do you feel when you hear those kinds of statistics, Katie? The fact that you're here to tell your story.
Yeah, it's mind blowing because it truly is one of those things that you kind of, you know, you only see on Grey's Anatomy or you hear about on the news, but to have it be somebody who it happens to, it makes you really truly appreciate, you know, your family and those that are around you and support you. And, you know, it just makes you more grateful for just being able to wake up every day and be with your family and go to work and, you know, even go and get the mail kind of thing. So I'm just much more appreciative of all the little things in life now.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, Katie. And I think you are incredibly blessed. And I'm so grateful to be able to hear that you're doing well, that you're both your sons are doing well, your husband is there, and wow, a lot to celebrate, especially for the holidays. So I'm so glad that you're okay. Really, truly, I just think it's amazing. You don't get to, as a news journalist, you don't really get to hear about a lot of great news stories in today's world. And on top of those, you very rarely hear about miracles. But I think it's safe to say your story is one of the miracles out there. So thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about it.
Absolutely. And please stay healthy. And I look forward to hearing what you name baby number two. I'm excited. Can't wait to hear the update. I can't wait. I'm telling you, middle name's got to be Holy something. Holy Toledo. I don't know. I'm trying to think. I believe, I could be wrong, this might be my insane love for Disney, but I believe Marvel means miracle. I think it does. I think, but I don't know how many people name their kids Marvel, but if you want, right? I think for a middle name though, maybe, like, and then he'll be really popular in elementary school. Like, whoa, like Spider-Man Marvel? You're like, yup, that's
exactly
right. Marvel like Spider-Man. I love it. Well, congratulations again, Katie. And I'm so glad that you're here. I hope you and your family have a beautiful holiday.
Thank you so much.
Again, Katie Stewart, a miracle right here in front of us on WICC. And I'm so glad I got the opportunity to share her story.